session number 24654, Reel 4.
Stress, but
no, you, I mean, a very important part of the Padanaya's job was, first of all, you're responsible for providing the battalion commander and the company commanders with the enemy, the information about the enemy. You were responsible for preparing all the maps for the battle, and then with your aid of your intelligence section, you know, I have a section of some 6 or 7 people, intelligence sergeant and couple of corporals and so on. You see, they do a lot of that work. Map, they maintain the battle maps as well.
Where did intelligence about the enemy come from? At your level, at battalion level?
Well, it will either come down from brigade, or it's intelligence you've gathered yourself within the battalion through patrols, interrogation of prisoners of war. I mean, one would always get prisoners, and you interrogate them to a limited amount. If you've got the time, and indeed you can cope with the language problem. I mean, I happen to know some German, but there wasn't always enough, because sometimes your prisoners were not even German speaking. There might be Poles or Russians, yeah. Hungarians, and that very often they were.
And your prisoners, leaving aside the language question, the prisoners that you took were, I wouldn't say happy to speak, but you could get them to speak. They would speak. They would talk.
Oh, they normally would talk. Yes,
they would.
Yes, yes.
Even the German ones.
Oh yeah, yes. They were frightened. They were very, very frightened. They thought you were going to kill them, and of course, I'm afraid some of them did get killed. Actually, that was obvious. I mean, you send prisoners back, and I am pretty certain some of them didn't get back.
And this was people responsible for that within the battalion, or you had other troops who you might have delegated?
I've got my suspicions that some of our escorts that went back managed to get back to the battalion pretty quickly, because when they go back, they very often then become very exposed in shell fire and so on. I'm pretty certain that there was the odd person who was bumped off.
Yes.
Pretty certain of that. I'm appalled by it, but nevertheless, I'm certain it happened.
Yes. And that was, of course, men from within the Dorset Regiment.
Yeah, yes. I think it's one of those things that happened in wartime. Terrible.
Can I take you back to this first attack on this chateau, where you had a total of 200 casualties? Can I just ask you, what would be the rough ratio between men killed to wounded of all types in that 200 out of 800? It's a huge ratio.
Yeah, I would have thought we must have lost. Let me have a look.
Yes,
might be able to see exactly what the casualties were. I think we. I'm
you're
not certain we always put
your
the casualties
war
down in case.
Now, Jack, you've consulted the Dorset War Diary, but it doesn't actually give a figure on the pages that you looked at. Can you give me an estimate of what the breakdown might be?
I would have thought we must have lost at 50, because the one I mentioned, the subaltern, the platoon commander, I mean, he was found about 3 days after the battle that he'd had attacked with the whole of his platoon, and the whole of the platoon had been shot. So there were 30 there. So we must have lost at least 50 or 60 killed.
Right.
On that attack.
And these 30, this platoon was lost not having been taken prisoner, but just lost in the process of
the attack. They'd actually crossed a hedge. Well, it was known as the Bocage country.
Yes.
Where all your fields were encased in these high hedgerows and ditches, the Bocage. And the Germans had dug themselves in on the reverse side of these things with machine guns. So it was a struggle to get across the hedge. And then you crossed into this open field surrounded by high hedges, and you were trapped. And he was in one, with his platoon, got into one of these fields. And they were simply mown down.
By machine guns on the far side?
Yeah. And we actually were there for about 5 or 6 days, and a very heavy shell fire the whole time for 5 or 6 days.
Because the Germans were trying to dislodge you.
Yes, because we were up against, well, I mean, I think we quote it occasionally, up against virtually the cream of the German army. We were up against SS divisions. I mean, that was a bit of, I mean, we were part of Monty's plan, which was at the time criticised for being slow, and the Americans were fast. Because the trouble, what I didn't appreciate, Monty was actually drawing off all the main strengths of the German army to the Caen area to so that he could, on his right flank, do the breakout of Normandy, which is precisely what happened. Now, of course, we were up against, well, in fact, I think we were up against, we weren't up against an SS division at the time, 21st Panzer Grenadiers. Now, they were one of the cream of the German army. And we had something like 5 Panzer divisions on that part of the front, up against 2 or 3 British divisions.
Yes. Yes.
And that included, on our left, 7th Armoured Division, which you referred to. And the great bombing attack, 1,000 aircraft raids south of Caen to enable the first Canadian Corps on our left to break out to the east of Caen with 3 armored divisions. Now that's what drew the Germans to the east.
Yes.
And of course they felt very vulnerable being east, being nearer, you know, the Seine and so on, when the main attack eventually came out to our west, the
yes.
American sector, which actually included my division, because we were pulled out and we did that attack to the west.
Well, we'll come to that, if we may, but I'd just like to come back to this. I don't think we need to dwell, unless you would wish to, on every single action in which your battalion was involved, but I would like to look in quite close detail, if possible, at one, and it might as well be the first as any. And unless you prefer to, of course, do later on if you wish, talk about others if you wish. But you've engaged in this attack on the chateau. You've had a quarter of the battalion are now no longer fit for action, and so you have only 600 men at your disposal. What does what is the CO? You're with the CO all the time, as you've said. What is the CO at this time doing? How does he convey to his frontline captains and platoon and company commanders what he wants done? Many of whom have been lost.
Yes, well, of course you had now your second 11, so to speak,
yes.
Take over. It was worse than that in some respects, because the CO, the commanding officers of both the other battalions, the 4th Dorsets, which was our other battalion, and our other battalion within the brigade was the 7th Hampshires. The CO of the 4th Dorsets, his battalion was virtually routed by an enemy, by a German counterattack. He himself, as a consequence, was removed from command. And one of our company commanders took over command of that battalion. And I'll come back to him because he's pretty relevant. And the 7th Hampshire's company CO was killed, because his head cut off. And our second in command took over his battalion. So we had the extraordinary situation where all 3 commanding officers were from the same battalion.
Yes.
And just jumping ahead for a little while, my commanding officer became the brigade commander eventually. So the brigade commander and 3 battalion commanders all came from the same battalion. And it was a bit like a boys' meeting when we went to the battalion O groups and things, brigade O groups. So that goes back to my point about the CO who became the brigade commander, and I still had that relationship with him, which was pretty close. And as an aside, most of our company commanders, except one, were in their early 20s. And we had this very old commanding officer, very old man, as he was, and the CO was a very old man.
What age is an old man?
38.
Yes.
And we regard him as an old man, and we couldn't believe it. I mean, everybody else was in their 20s.
So he's, of course, a regular soldier.
He was a Wiltshire, yes. And his name was, as I've already mentioned, Aubrey Toad.
Yes. And a highly competent officer?
Well, of course, jumping ahead a little while, because it's worth it. He eventually became, as I said, the brigade commander. He commanded us right up through. He became brigade commander after Arnhem. But after Arnhem, he became the brigade commander. And then after the war, he commanded a brigade and took it to Hong Kong. And that was the brigade that went to Korea. He became very famous, called Code of Korea. And he eventually became a divisional commander. And then, in due time, died. But he became a general.
So I'll take you back, if I may, to the day of the battle. Can you describe for me what you would have been doing during the course of that day as the troops went out of their sunken road and attempted to attack?
Yes. Yeah, well, I was with the commanding officer most of the time.
Yep.
When he had to go forward and talk to find out what companies were doing or to urge everybody on, I was, in a sense, with what we call TAC headquarters, tactical headquarters of the battalion, which would be pretty close to the forward area anyway. I mean, part of the forward area. And that was my job, to sort of keep things together, keep him in touch. Keep companies informed.
Yes.
As well. In fact, during that battle, we lost contact with one of our companies. So I
this had is wireless contact. You were in wireless contact.
Wireless contact.
In theory, you were in wireless contact.
Yeah, we lost it. We had no idea what was going on. Yeah. So I had to go and find them, got myself shot up and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, that was a sort of thing one was doing all the time.
Yes. So you had to go and find them. You had to cross the battlefield, go and find them.
Yeah.
And see what they were up to so you could then report back to the CO.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And, yes, I found them, under pretty heavy fire they were at the time too.
Yes.
So we, as I said, we were there for 4 or 5 days, and then we moved back to prepare ourselves for the breakout from Normandy.
So you engaged in this battle, which involved the taking of the chateau, together with its aftermath, for 5 days.
Yeah. There was one important thing, which I should have mentioned, and it's something I feel strong about. The most dangerous operation of war is patrolling, without question. Infantry patrolling. Probably the second most dangerous thing to be is to be the forward observation officer for the gunners. They're very brave people, stuck out and probably for longer than any infantry battalion, so they often have to stay there when the next battalion comes in.
Yes.
But those two operations are the most dangerous. So during that period, our FOOs were out there and we were patrolling. And my job as a battalion IO was to brief patrols about going out and debriefing them when they come back. And after they got a bit of experience, and certain officers and certain NCOs had some talent for this, but you knew damn well when you briefed them, they may never come back. And I mean, that was a pretty tough thing.
So the front line, of course, is not a front line in the old-fashioned conventional sense. It's a static.
Oh yes, yes.
I mean, sorry, it's a movable place with strong points, and
yeah,
and you could move in between there.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. It is in fact a series of probably platoon and company localities.
Yes,
they're the strong points, but there'd be big gaps in between which you can move in and out of. So you move through your own lines into the German area. The object of the exercise either to see what you can see where they are, or to try and capture a prisoner.
Take a prisoner.
And bring them back.
And they'd do the same, of course.
And they would try and do the same. The British Army is pretty good at patrolling. It's a talent we had.
I was going to ask, yeah. I've heard this before, were the Germans as good at it or as frequent at it as you were?
I suspect they were not as good or as frequent at it. It's a part of the culture of the British Army. So wherever you were at night, you put out patrols. Every night. Every night you put a patrols out. We didn't see those number of German patrols. But we did every night.
Yep.
Well, almost every night, anyway.
Okay. So, at the end of this very intensive five-day period, which is very exhausting, the battalion has taken 200 casualties.
And a lot more during the rest of the 5 days.
And a lot more.
Because of shelling, yes.
Okay. When you come back then, when you come out of the line, the battalion strength is what, roughly, would you say? Just roughly?
Probably about 600.
600?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you start getting reinforcements, and I know we did get reinforcements. I mean, our first lot of reinforcements were former Royal Artillery ACAC from Italy that had been converted to infantry, and they joined the battalion. And they rapidly became just as good as anybody else. That's what we were so surprised about. I haven't spent about 4 years training, and these people have been about 6 weeks. Yeah, they've still gone pretty good.
Is it because of a shortage of German aircraft to shoot at?
It was because of the collapse of the war in Italy.
Yes, because you didn't need so many.
Yes, that was the first thing. I mean, the British Army was pretty short of recruits by that time. So you were trying to get them from every source.
Right, okay. So you withdraw from the line. We're now roughly early July,
we're getting towards the end of July.
Because the action commenced, I think, on the 10th of July.
10th of July, yeah.
So, in the
so about mid-July we've become...
Second half of July you retire from the front line. And then what do you do, James?
Well, we came back to rest areas, which will be behind, to prepare for our next battle. And our next battle was at a place called Caumont, where the division, the whole division, was a part of this American attack. They came under American command there and did the breakout from Normandy. I know that you will have heard and know of the Falaise Gap.
Yes.
Well, we were part of the Falaise Hook. We came round from the west and eventually saw the carnage that was created by that. Now, we had quite a big battle to get it to make that breakout, but it was not as severe from our point of view as the battle for the Chateau, the first one.
So not as severe in terms of casualties?
We made more rapid advance.
Did you?
Yes.
Were you absolutely in the front line?
I was right in the forward area. I mean, that's when we were doing the attack.
Were actually doing the attack?
Absolutely. We're not just following up.
Battalion
objectives.
This may seem a daft question, but where were the Germans then, if you were right in the front line and yet you were able to advance well? Had they retreated?
Well, they were moving fast back, too.
Were they?
Yeah.
They were getting out of the way.
Yes, I mean, they were fighting a rearguard action, really.
They were.
And, of course, all that led to the rapid advance as a consequence of that towards the Seine. On the way, there was a very famous battle in the history of Normandy battle called Mount Pinçon. Although my battalion didn't actually attack Mount Pinçon, which is sort of halfway between Normandy and the Seine. It was a massive feature which the Germans were holding, but my division did. We were, in a sense, a reserve battalion for that. But one battalion of my brigade was directly involved. We were actually on the mount ourselves, but we weren't quite so close as everybody else. Now, that really was a very severe climb. And it was the loss, once we captured, 43rd Division captured Mount Pinçon, actually released the floodgates. We had Patton's Third Army on our immediate right, And he was moving rapidly and almost out of control, because his target was Berlin.
Immediately, yes.
Yeah, straight away. So as we were on the right of the British Second Army, and the Americans were on our immediate right. So we were heading straight for the Seine.
Now, when you were under American command, your entire division was under American command.
Yes,
it was obviously part of an American corps then.
Yeah.
Were there any...
Well, it'd be part of the US First Army.
Right. Yeah. Were there any liaison difficulties, or how
none,
did you...
None at all. None at all. No.
It all worked very smoothly.
Yes, it did. In many ways. I don't think it was any problem. I mean, I don't think many of us were... I don't know. The American troops had a way of behaving and conducting themselves in battle that were completely alien to us. I mean, it was not the same way. I mean, they were a dirty, scruffy bunch of. I'm pro-Americans. I mean, I know America itself, but nevertheless, one had to recognise they were sometimes a pretty ill-disciplined lot.
Were they?
Oh, yes.
Even the frontline
troops were ill-disciplined. Yes. It's not because they were deliberately ill-disciplined. That was their sort of way of behaving. That might even go back to what happened in Iraq. I mean, they are believing massive firepower and not too much imagination about it. They never seem to wash or shave or clean themselves up. Or when an American's morale is low, it's bloody low, very, very low indeed. But when it's high, it's extremely high. And that seems to have a middle phlegmatic course that the British have, you know. It's a, Marleesh, you know. I might be dead tonight, you know.
Right. And how long were you a member of the First Corps? Your division?
I mean, First Army. Until we got to the Seine.
Really?
No, after Mount Pinçon. And from then onwards, we were back. Our main cause, it was not my division that was a part of Secretary, it was a whole corps, it was the 12th Corps, British 12th Corps, served as a part of the American French First Army.
And your corps commander would be a man called Ritchie?
Oh, that's interesting, yes.
Neil Ritchie?
Yeah, I think it was Neil Ritchie.
Right, as you mentioned Horrocks. He comes later.
Yeah, but he commanded 30 Corps, we spent most of our time in 30. We spent most of our time in 30 Corps.
Right.
In fact, virtually the whole war in 30 Corps, except
for the
beginning. Except the very beginning. Yes. If I remember rightly, Neil Ritchie was relieved.
I don't know.
Yes, I think he was.
Right.
He commanded 8th Army for a very short while and was relieved. Yes.
Right.
But I think, anyway, it's funny you should know that. I forgot about him. Anyway.
So after Mount Pinçon, you revert to British command?
Yeah. We wouldn't have noticed much about America. I've only mentioned that most soldiers wouldn't know they were Americans or not. And we then headed for the Seine and a place called Vernon. And we, sorry?
Yes, no, please do carry on.
Yeah, and we actually, because you're a cop. We arrived in Vernon, and then we did the attack across the river at the Seine. We crossed the Seine, captured the bridge at Vernon, and it was the first British crossing of the Seine. That was my battalion. Well, my brigade. Two battalions did that.
Your battalion was one of those that crossed the bridge?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Was it an opposed crossing? Or
oh, yes.
It was?
Yeah.
How do you go about crossing?
Well, we did it in a mixture of boats under smoke and a mixture of... The bridge itself had collapsed, been blown by the Germans, and therefore it was in the water. But there was enough, you could actually get across on it. So we did, I remember, I cut two companies up and crossed the river. There weren't many Germans the other side, really. It wasn't that difficult. We had a few casualties, but it wasn't a serious issue in that sense. But it was a key strategic issue, getting that crossing the Seine. And after we crossed the Seine, we were rested and provided the bridgehead for the 11th Armour Division, and the Guards Armour Division went straight through us and straight up to Brussels. And we followed immediately behind them.
So Jack, you've gone into reserve with the Armour Divisions having gone past you. What?
And then we were there for, I don't know, a few days. Certainly enough time for some of us, including me, to go down to Paris. And where, just as an aside, we met a young Frenchman, a young lad, he was about 20, he was at the Sorbonne at the University. And he said, "I'd like to come with you." And so we dressed him up in British Army uniform and French thing. And his mother was English. He spoke, obviously, French is his first language, but he also spoke very good German as well. So we took him as our interpreter.
Yeah.
A chap called Pierre Dublay. And he came with us all the way to Arnhem. And just as a quick aside story, because it's a nice little story, he lived with us in our officers' mess, if you like, you know, with the officers anyway. And then at Arnhem, where he had to get back to university, because the university year started, Monty's aircraft, who happened to have come up, took him back to Paris. And he went back. He subsequently wrote a book, a bit like Colonel Bramble, where I and the battalion figure, it was about all the battalion in his adventures, which he won a very famous prize for. And he's subsequently killed in Algeria as a press war correspondent. Very sad. But it was the sort of thing that, you know, often did. You'd pick up this youngster, and he did a good job with us, and we're all very fond of him.
What was Paris like? This is immediately after.
They were still fighting for it when we got there.
Really?
There was still shooting going on, yes. Yeah, round. We weren't in there about 4 hours in the jeep.
Oh,
we took down, just dashed down and had a quick look. I didn't think the CO knew we'd gone. Well, we couldn't resist it. And he did know, because we brought Pierre back with us. I had to ask my mum, he said.
And yes, he would be a useful addition to the battalion.
Well, he was, because he was able to interrogate the old Germans and they, very well, but that was very helpful. And he was such a nice person. You know. He stood the same amount of fire as everybody else did. You know. Yeah.
So when the term started back,
he had to go back to university. He was a very bright young man, and I've got his book in French, and what he wrote about us. Anyway, we then dashed forward and joined up in Brussels.
So you have effectively rested for a short while.
We did this quick race across France and Belgium, the rest of France and Belgium, for all these cheering crowds all the time, and crowds and crowds of people. And we got to Brussels, and we rested in Brussels a couple of days. And I can remember on the first night we were there, I and another officer, we went out into Brussels itself. We were very close to the town centre. And we had a jeep, and coming back late at night, having been around the pubs or the equivalent, there was a very elderly gentleman came up to us. Oh no, it was a bit earlier in the evening he came up to us, that was it. It was before we'd come in home, but we were in our jeep anyway, we were on this part, and he came up And he said how pleased he was to see us and all that. He spoke very good English as well. A very elderly man. And he said, would you like to come and have dinner with us? And we last thing we wanted to do, he said, well, if you... We made some excuses. And he said, well, if you have a chance, you can come and please come and see me. And he gave us his card. I stuck it in my pocket. He gave me a card anyway. So, and I subsequently looked, and it was Carton de Veer, who was the ex-Prime Minister of Belgium. Now, I'd have loved to take that up if I'd have only realised, looked at the time. Yes, but of course it was all too late. Anyway, there was a sort of little story. We were in Brussels for long enough to be briefed about the Arnhem operation.
So we're now early September.
Yes.
Just quickly tell me what was, one's heard about the cheering crowds and so on, what was a big city like Brussels like 1 week or 2 days after it had been liberated?
No, it was
after
just...
After the Germans had gone.
Just people everywhere.